Welcome to The Steer, the show where we talk to writers about music and musicians about books, hosted by Jeff Alessandrelli and Joshua James Amberson.
Joshua.
Jeff.
How are you?
Doing well. How about you?
Good. Your sweatshirt's teal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why?
Why? Why is it teal? Or why do I like teal?
Why does teal exist on the spectrum of colors?
I don't know much about color theory, quite honestly.
Color theory is like Ellsworth Kelly. Do you like
Kelly? I don't. Yeah, I know the name, but I again, I don't know much about it.
Well, color theory. I think of color in terms of painters, and he's somebody who uses it's just all color.
Yeah. Right. I really like the stamps, the Ellsworth Kelly stamps that they did last year. Did you see those?
No.
They were larger, and they were like his big blocks of colors, and they look great. I used them for months.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
I really keep up with stamps, yeah.
But do you really?
I do, yeah. Well, I mean, I mail a lot of things through...
Well, right.
Yeah, the online store I run, and some of those are just... future, and there's just stamped envelopes sometimes, you know, for whatever single zine or, you know, sending, you know, people buy a couple postcards or something. So I do keep, though I have a home, you know, where I print labels and things for packages, I also keep a lot of stamps. I'm always asking what the new stamps are that came out, and my, you know, the people at the post office are like, hey, we got some new stamps. You know, they're my friends. But
because you want to have people over commenting like this is a cool stamp, or you like?
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate it when I get things that have interesting stamps rather than just a flag or
things
like
that.
So I this year the 3-ounce stamp is a Walt Whitman stamp.
I got T-Rex a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
Maybe I just got dinosaurs. So wait, the 3-ounce?
3 ounces is, what, now 91 cents or something, but it's for something slightly heavier, so I use a lot of those.
And it's Whitman.
It's Whitman, yeah. For the last 2-plus years, it's been Henry James.
Why?
Yeah. The 3-ounce stamps are always writers.
Okay, I did not know that.
Yeah. I mean, it's been a period of time. I don't know how long. Last 10 years, at least. So yeah.
For 2 years, though, it was Henry James?
Yeah.
Do people read Henry James anymore?
I don't think so.
Yeah, it's interesting that he would be the person. Huh.
Yeah, they just didn't change it. They've just been sitting on Henry James. It's been a bummer.
It's because no one was buying Henry James, so they had, like, Whitman, I bet, will sell. Was there Dickinson back in the day? Were there a bunch of different...
There should be, yeah.
But it runs the gamut.
It runs the gamut, yeah.
Okay. We should say something about Gabrielle
we
Seville.
Should. Yeah.
So we interviewed her.
Mm-hmm.
She's a performance artist.
Mm-hmm.
She lives in LA, but she's from Detroit.
Yeah.
And I met her initially, it's 2020, in 2017 in Iowa, at the Mission Creek Festival. And she was, I think she must've been doing a reading, but I didn't see her at the reading or I didn't see her at her reading. Saw her at the actual book fair, and her book, which came out on civil coping mechanisms, Janice Lee Coe does that. It's a really amazing book, Swallow the Fish, and it's basically a compendium of her different performances wrapped up in, a memoir essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And so since then, we kind of struck up a friendship. And her new book, Experiments and Joy, came out last year and was long list nominated for the Believer Book Award in nonfiction, which is kind of a big deal, for civil coping mechanisms, the accomplices there. It's a great press, but I mean, you know, it's not FSG. And some of the other books on that list are from bigger presses. So it was cool. And she was in Portland to do a reading at Portland State, and so it was great that we got to talk to her. You did not know her work really.
I did not know her work, and of course that's one of the really exciting things about the show is that we're each bringing people that we're, if not acquainted with, at least fans of. And I feel like I really like the process of making each other fans of new people's work. And so really excited about what I read and watched preparing for the interview. And it was kind of a last minute interview. You know, we got it together, you know, the day before or something. And so kind of cramming.
We're pros.
Yeah, her work, you know, was really exciting and fun. And and she's great. She's so great. She's,
and Prince.
Yeah.
A lot of this interview
Well, yeah, she sent us her music list, and it was, you know, it started with a kind of big bang of deep cut Prince songs and her relationship with Prince. And so I knew we'd have a lot to talk about because I'm a big Prince fan too. And I feel like has been, you know, opening me up in just these last couple of days to new Prince.
Well, yeah, and Prince, I know Prince, nothing, yeah. But Parade, mm-hmm. Is that what we talked about for a while?
Yeah, the album Parade,
yeah.
Which has, you know, been a difficult album for me, and yeah, I'm giving it some more listens, and it's been great.
Well, yeah, and hopefully our listeners can give it some listens too, even though Prince's catalog is well-established. All right, this is Gabrielle Saville.
Song that had did you hear and you're like, I didn't know that was Prince. And I was
really? There's a lot of songs. I don't know his entire catalog. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, first of all, his entire catalog is massive. And it's true so that massive. If you don't already have a relationship with the catalog, it can be daunting and overwhelming to even figure out what to do because there's the hits, but that's just the tip of the iceberg, really. Yeah.
But you're not from Minneapolis.
No, although I am from, born and raised in the Kingdom of Detroit, which is really almost like a number two Prince city. I mean, Prince used to come and celebrate his birthday in Detroit.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and have birthday concerts and pop. I mean, so there's a very strong Detroit Prince love and a kind of Detroit connection. And then, of course, I did live in Minneapolis for almost 13 years. And so you want to talk about some people who really love Prince and people from across all boundaries. I mean, it was really amazing, and it was awfully, was terribly sad when Prince died, of course, in 2016. But I went to the Minnesota State Fair that year, the best state fair in the United States of America, I will have you know, the Minnesota State Fair.
Okay.
What, are you going to try to say something about Nevada? You think Nevada State Fair's got something?
I mean, actually, I wasn't going to try to say something about Nevada, but I'm... I just went to the rain taxi thing one time in Minneapolis. Is it at like a fairground type thing? Is it in the winter?
No. In fact, it's the maybe like 13 days or 2 weeks right before Labor Day.
Okay.
And it heralds the passage from summer to fall, and they call it the Great Minnesota Get Together, and everybody is there. And that is really true. I mean, there are people of color, white people, just like old, young people, children. And then they have, it's really huge. And they have musical acts that come, and you'll see, what's that thing? That hippie super group. Like, whatever. They'll bring whoever.
What do you mean? Fish?
No.
String Cheese Incident?
No.
That's a hippie.
What's that dude?
Bob Ware.
What's the thing that Donald Fagen is in?
Oh, Steely Dan.
Thank you. So I think of Steely Dan as a hippie supergroup, but maybe now I'm gonna get hate mail now.
That's
to the steer or whatever.
Erroneous, but we can. Yeah.
I just, you know, they have.
But
a big following.
But they're big, and they played at that thing, and that the Minnesota
State
Fair.
Yeah, I mean, and I
want
to say, like, maybe did the Roots come and play there? Or like, I mean, they have ranges of music that are people are coming there to play, and then they've got side stages, and then you still have food, and like you have a bottomless cup of milk for 25 cents, and you can see the quote unquote miracle of birth. There's always calves. Anyway, the year that Prince died, there was seed art that was done in the image of Prince, and there was
That's funny, because I was gonna say my friend Kathy, who lives here in Portland, does seed art she's from Minneapolis, and she every year she goes back to the state fair and submits her seed art, and I believe she did Prince seed art that year.
And
so.
She was not alone.
Yeah.
But what it means is I saw her art.
Yeah, you probably did.
I saw it. And then they had, you know, prints and the butter, because, you know, they were like butter sculptures and you have like butter queens
butter
and
sculptures.
Stuff. It is a real, it's really something that's
maybe
left of America.
Maybe for your artwork, we can do a butter sculpture of Prince.
I think that'd be amazing. Mm-hmm. Although it's already done. So I feel like I need to do some, maybe I'll take a butter sculpture of Prince and do some performance art with it. Just get a lot of toast and eat it.
But when did you get into him?
Oh, well, like, my older sister was a Prince fan, and so I grew up with Prince in the house. I mean, some of the people that I know in Detroit, they felt like he peaked at 1999, which was the album before Purple Rain. Like, they are old school Prince fans. Dirty Mind, Controversy, even the first album For You, which most people don't even listen to. And then the Prince album. See, Joshua is nodding because you know. I mean, the Prince
very
album, we're on the
albums.
Back of it. I mean, he's like on a Pegasus.
He's on a Pegasus.
I mean,
and,
you know,
off,
his hair is like flowing. It's all straightened out and flow. I mean, and that's an album that is really meaningful to me. I love that record a lot. And in fact, I mean, one link, I don't know if it's in the book or not, but I'm thinking about it because Valentine's Day is just in a few days. And the very last song on that album, When We're Dancing Slow and Close, was like my song actually with Mo Lynel, who is in that my latest book, Experiments in Joy. And so for a while there, I couldn't listen to that song. You know, I would be listening to that album and be like, oh, turning that off. I don't want to hear that, because that was our song, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. But it's such an amazing song. I love that song.
That is a great song.
So yeah. I feel like I finally matured because I can listen to that song now.
You got past it.
I got
past
it. Yeah.
That is a very not oft-referenced Prince song, you
or
know?
Bambi. So,
yeah,
you know?
Bambi.
I'm sorry, we're geeking out here, and Jeff is like, I don't know what you
well,
are
no,
talking
I
want to
play, you sent us Power Fantastic.
Power Fantastic.
But wait, so when we were in Iceland, and I think it was Aisha Sabatini Sloan.
Yes, remember? Aisha Sabatini Sloan.
Aisha?
I know, it's confusing, because it's spelled like Aisha, but they pronounce it Aisha, and
Aisha.
I met her mom, who's a lovely person. And her mother said, yeah, I really liked how that was spelled, but I didn't like how it sounds. So we spelled it that way, but we say Aisha.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
and then Aisha said, you named me a name that you didn't like how it was pronounced. So anyway,
well, what was
Aisha,
what was the title of your panel called, or what was that? I don't know their pronoun, but she.
Uh-huh.
Didn't she do a Prince movie that I had no...
Tessa Bryant, who I want to represent and lift up because I love her so much, too. Tessa Bryant did a Neo Benchy too, Under the Cherry Moon. So do you guys know that form of a Benchy where it's like a Japanese form where there would be text that you would write to accompany a film?
Okay.
And so today,
and that's called what?
A Benchy. And then a Neo Benchy is like contemporizing that form. So there are poets and writers that will take clips. Like I know Jackie Wang has done this with RoboCop or whatever. And you string together clips from a movie and then you talk over it. And you've written text that you talk over it. And so the panel in Iceland, so this was at the Nonfiction Now conference that was in 2018.
It was 2018?
Isn't that wild? It was 2018 because it was 2 years ago. Yeah. And they're about to have one in New Zealand.
It feels like it was like 10 years ago.
I know, because so much
like
has happened.
Or like 2 weeks ago. Yeah, okay.
Both, exactly. So Aisha Sabatini Sloan put together this fabulous panel, and it was called Black Women in Ekphrasis. And so there were all these different takes on art writing. And it was Aaliyah Adegweme, myself, Samia Bashir, and then I'm trying to see, am I missing anyone? And then, of course, Tessa. There might be someone else, but I think that's all of us. And Tessa Bryant, she did an extraordinary Neo Benchy, sort of like a vocal talk over with these clips of Under the Cherry Moon, which was the movie that went along with Prince's sixth album, Parade, which is an album that I really love and has a lot of classical influences. And if I'm not mistaken, is the album. So you had Purple Rain, which was in 1984. And then right after Purple Rain, you had Around the World in a Day, which was sort of Prince being kind of like hippie-ish, or it was kind of Beatles influence. See, Joshua's nodding because you're like, yes, I'm getting it right. And Parade is right after that. And Parade was the soundtrack to Under the Cherry Moon. And in it, if you have not seen this film, Prince is a gigolo who's living in the south of France. The film is in black and white. It was Kristen Scott Thomas's very first film ever, the British actress. And she was playing like Mary Scott, Mary, I don't remember her last name anymore.
Don't remember either. Yeah.
But he, with Jerome from the time, Jerome Benton is his sidekick. They are just like running around in the south of France, and then he's trying to woo Mary. That's what it is. And so it's this like interracial thing. But in the meantime, what Tisa did, she spliced together all of the footage where there were black women in that movie. Mm. And that was extraordinary for me because I didn't even remember that there were black women in the movie. But actually, there are quite a few.
Hmm.
There really are. And he's giving a flower or a rose to one. Or he's like, they're all there. So there's these kind of like silent moments that she swings together. And so she does a conversation or just she, her presentation is very much about rethinking race and representation in that particular aesthetic art object, which is that movie, Under the Cherry Moon.
Hmm.
So if anyone is listening to this, definitely invite Tisa Bryant to come to your place and do this presentation because it was quite extraordinary.
Oh, my God, I want to see this.
It was extraordinary. Yeah. She's awesome.
Okay, let's listen to a bit of Power Fantastic by Prince and then maybe talk a bit about the Prince zine. That you
cool.
Both. So is that him singing?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
Yeah.
He has a very high voice.
The falsetto that he could get was, I mean, and he also has a very low voice. Mm. And actually his speaking voice was super, super low.
Yeah, right.
So
yeah.
That range in his singing and in his speech is pretty incredible.
You'll have to, I mean, I know this from the B-side.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it hits three. But I don't know what it's a B-side to. It sounds Parade era, but
I think it is.
Is it? Yeah.
But I don't know for sure. I mean, because that's really how I first encountered it. But
yeah.
But it seems like it because that's Eric Leeds, and I remember I'm trying to think of because Claire Fisher arranged it, but Eric Leeds is doing the horns, and I just love like the flute and that.
Right.
I mean, it's such a funny thing to be representing Prince with a song like that, which is such a deep cut, but I wanted to signal something about what Prince meant to me, and there's something in that record that was so romantic and so like aspiring and so reaching towards a certain kind of life and love and connection that I really identify with an aspect of myself, especially in adolescence. And so I was sort of coming to think of myself as a writer and the kind of life I wanted to live. And there's something in that version of Prince that's very earnest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because Prince can be very snarky as well, for sure. But like in Power Fantastic and certain other songs in his catalog, especially more of the deep cuts, there's something about love, but there's also something about just trying to be in the world a certain way. And I felt growing up that I wanted to try to be in the world in a certain way, and that was connected for me to being an artist and being a writer and traveling and having love affairs and being around beautiful things like flowers and artworks. And so I had a very like romantic, and still do in many ways, very romantic idea about the world and about life, and a song like that really tapped into that feeling for me.
Did you ever meet him?
No, although of course I lived in a place where there were people who were, you know, like grew up with or grew next to or, you know, like were going, but I never had the chance to meet him, which is a great sort of sorrow in my life.
I was going to say, would you have wanted to meet him? Because sometimes expectations, like there are people who I've met who I really from afar liked, and then they let me down. Because I have a dream image of them that doesn't actually match up to who they actually are as a living human being. I mean, it sounds like Prince was a very important figure for you as an adolescent and getting older. I mean,
and now,
would you have, but you would have wanted to.
Yes, although you're saying something super real, because people can disappoint you. And also, one thing with people who I admire, I mean, there are some people that I'm just super content to just be a fan and not have to get into it. But I do feel, and I mean, with someone like Prince, there's no way I'm not on the same creative level as Prince, I don't think. But I also feel like Prince befriended a lot of younger artists, and he saw them as artists. And I think a dream of mine would have been to collaborate on some level, even if it was in a conversation about a project, to talk about something that was meaningful. So in the posthumous memoir that just came out, I'm still in it, but you have to understand, and this is so funny that this is the first thing we're talking about, because I know I sound like a wingnut, but when Prince died, that felt like a fabric in the universe was like torn for me. I felt like there was a real breach, and I thought, what is even going to happen in terms of culture and my relationship to pop culture? I just felt like, oh, now I'm a part of a past, because whatever else is happening, I don't have anything to do with it. I mean, it really felt huge. And so I have The Beautiful Ones. I received it as a gift, which was great. Like almost immediately, someone just sent it to me. But I have to go through that very slowly, because it distresses me so much that Prince is not here anymore. But I read the introduction, and what's interesting about the introduction is the writer, I think his name is Dan, I don't know exactly his last name, so you'll have to forgive me. I mean, it's like Dan Pepinbridge or something like that.
Yeah, he wrote for the Pippenberg or something.
Yeah.
He wrote for the Paris Review, or he was.
Forgive us, Dan. We don't have your name right.
We'll find,
know who you are. But he talked about how, you know, you had to write an essay. There was a little competition to be able to do it.
Yeah.
And then when he came, so then, you know, you had an interview with Prince, and Prince came, it's like us, he came with the essay and a red pen, and was basically like, I have a question about this word right here, or this thing that you did. I mean, and in a way, it kind of freaked Dan out, but another way, this dude was like looking at what he was writing seriously, and they were having a serious conversation that wasn't just, I've always loved you, and here's my autograph. It's like they were talking about something. And so that would be more the way that I would want to kind of know Prince, even just to, or when Misty Copeland talked about when they were doing a little collaboration where she was dancing on his piano or something. But the way that they talked about it was serious. It was like, well, what is the energy that we want? Why don't we try this? Why don't we do? So I feel like I would have loved to have had an opportunity to be even in a small creative conversation with Prince, because that's really where he, it seems from what I've read, that's where he came alive with people.
Yeah, I mean, but he was very, would you call him a control freak? Or, I mean, you collaborate, like, as an artist, did he impact you in a lot of ways?
Well, let's go back here. Joshua, you're even more of an expert than I am on Prince.
I don't know if that's true. You know a lot, yeah.
I mean, would you characterize Prince as a control freak?
I think in certain contexts, for sure.
Well, that's
a bad term. There's a lot
so
of
maybe
yeah.
that's. I mean, you two tell me. Because as an outside perspective, I get the sense that he definitely had a vision for things.
Yes.
And sometimes a vision can be overbearing on other people who you work with. And I guess I'm wondering, for your own work as an artist, is that type of ethic, I guess, something that you've thought about? I mean, because you do work with a lot of different people, but I think you yourself have a vision. But I mean, I guess I'm just curious.
You're asking an awesome question, because I think one thing I am trying to think about, this is my Libra nature, is how to stand in my own power, how to recognize my own vision, how to materialize those visions, and still be super open and listening to other people. And like in collaboration, so it's one thing too, if I come and I'm making an action, but it's a site specific thing, or I'm traveling to a place where I haven't been or in a venue I don't know. And then there are different technicians or people who are there and I'm listening and I'm working, but these people are trying to help me realize my vision. That's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's another thing where it's like, okay, well, Joshua, Jeff, you know, and I, we're going to make this thing together, but I kind of know what I want to do. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I need to not arrive and say like, okay, you two, this is what we're going to do. But I get to say, this is what I think. And so that balance, if you just want to take it back to Prince for one last time, I won't make us talk about Prince all the time.
Well, but, we can.
Well, but there's so many other like awesome, I mean, yeah. And I love, you know, Prince is my heart. So I love Prince. But there's some other people I have to like lift up too. But what I really, one lesson I feel like I learned from being a student of Prince in some ways, Prince was much more of a sponge, much more receptive and much more collaborative earlier in his career.
Okay, so that's interesting for me to know, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and definitely he always had a strong vision. I mean, even from 18, 19, 20, he was writing, producing. I mean, he knew he wanted to produce his own records. He knew he wanted to write them. He wanted to play the instruments. I mean, because he had a very strong sense of the sounds that he wanted to produce. And he wanted to have, I mean, that's throughout to the day he died, he always felt strong sense of authority and ownership and claiming over his own music. And that mm-hmm. was the whole thing with Warner Brothers and wanting to own his masters and all that stuff. But if you look at when he started working with The Revolution and especially Lisa and Wendy or even with Power Fantastic, when you're hearing all of those jazz sounds, he really grew up as a student of funk.
Mm-hmm.
Lisa and Wendy brought, I would say, like classical influences, mm-hmm. Some of that jazz orchestra. It was really him opening himself up to these musicians that had come from different backgrounds that then he integrated that into what he was doing. So he was listening to them. It still was always in the service of his own vision, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But he was listening. And I think that's that balance is interesting to me because I feel like there are certain things that I want to try to do as a writer, as a performance artist. I'm starting to become more interested in these things I'm calling performance stills, which maybe are moving me towards something like movies, even though that feels maybe grandiose to say. Mm-hmm. It's because I just moved to LA, I guess, that I'm thinking about movies. But I mean, how to have a vision, but also to be a sponge and learn from other people and integrate that and expand one's own vision to accommodate that. That's something I think as an artist I'm interested in doing.
Mm, yeah. When before, I think we should, because you sent us some great music to listen to and talk about. But one last Prince thing before we move on is that, you know, you pointed out Parade as a favorite album mm-hmm. and spoke so beautifully about it. And one thing when, I came to Parade as thinking of it as a soundtrack, right? A soundtrack with a couple songs I knew and liked on it. And kind of passed it by. It's not one I listened to when I was younger, you know, and I was like, oh, it's the soundtrack to a flop movie, you mm-hmm. know. And so I didn't really give it the time of day. And then when I came to it, it's such a disjointed album, seemingly, you know, that's just, I'm like, I don't know what to make of it other than the songs that I like or love off of it. And so when I wrote it up for the Prince scene, I was like, I don't like this album. Mm-hmm. And I have gotten, out of all of the things that people could respond negatively to in that zine, Parade has been number one. People have been like, great zine. I fiercely disagree with your opinions on Parade. And I'm like, wow, really? You know, like, and so I just keep going back to it and listen to it. And this morning, I nanny an 8-month-old. And this morning, you know, when I was reading your list, I was like, okay, baby, we got to listen to Parade together. And mm-hmm. we listened, and it was a really beautiful experience. And I really heard it in a new way, even before hearing what you had to say about it right now. And so it's been a really fun and incredible process to warm up to this album. Mm-hmm. And it's taken a really long time. And I'm just, I feel like each time I hear it anew. And it's an album that really opens up in interesting ways. And it's so daring and experimental, and it's difficult. It's, you know, even though there's pop on it, it's I find it a really challenging album for me, even as someone who likes experimental music and likes some of the more experimental side of Prince. It just, for some reason, it's tough for me.
You're making a connection for me, actually, to my book Experiments in Joy, because the way that you just described Parade, especially the kind of disjointed or experimental, or just the kind of the number of things that are even happening in that record, I can imagine that there are some people who would probably have that experience with that, with my book, which I always think of as a kind of mixtape. I mean, Swallow the Fish, my first book, was also collaged or had very hybrid, is maybe how I would call it, hybrid, critical, creative. But still, there was a much more coherent eye, I think, in Swallow the Fish, a kind of coming of age story about this kind of little black feminist who wants to become a performance artist and then has all of these little adventures and has meditations on different aspects of practice. Experiments and Joy is different, and it's so interesting for me now to think about why and how I even had the idea of maybe putting different kind of dissonant things together. And I wonder if it is connected to some of the things that I listen to, or thinking about the number of different kinds of things I listen to. And so, like, the soundtrack of my life. And so, you know, listening to, like, LL Cool J's Radio, and then Kate Bush is Running Up That Hill. I mean, if you want to talk about, we could do a whole show just on little preteen teen Gabrielle and the stuff I was listening then, and the mixtapes. And I'm such a pack rat weirdo. I mean, I still have mixtapes that Alicia Lupo made me in the eighth grade. I have the cassettes.
You've traveled with those?
I have.
Yeah, but I mean, it gets to that book, but sometimes our influences, we don't really even, they're so suffused into us that we can't even, like, I mean, one of the reasons, because nowadays people on Spotify and people on, and I'm not saying that this is good or bad, they have access to so many different things.
Right.
But I guess, I don't know if it was a conscious effort, but I mean, you were into different things at a young age, and you had to, like, kind of search them out or get them from people.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a different experience being 40 and being 18 and having those kind of listening experiences, I guess.
Absolutely. And it is a different experience to have Alicia Lupo, who, you know, I don't know where she is now, but she was super influential, like this white girl who lived in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and her mother ran the summer drama camp at Roper, this gifted school where I first, like, was on a stage and was moved. You know what I mean? So it was all, there was a whole ethos and mystique. And so listening to, like, Ricky Lee Jones or something, you know, yeah. I mean, where the hell was I going to hear any of that music? But so it's like white music, you know what I mean? And artsy music, you know? And I thought, like, this is this expression.
How old were you at this time?
So I was in maybe like 12 the first year, and then I came back and was 13. So that's when Joni Mitchell and Ricky Lee Jones and Kate Bush, those three came into my life right then. Prince was already there, okay? And then in my family, like, my mom loved jazz, but she loved, like, Al Jarreau and Chuck Mangione, but then also the classics in terms of John Coltrane. I mean, so really beautiful, like, classic jazz. And then my father, who's from Haiti, was listening to Haitian music, but also Charles Aznavour and, you know, but also Celia Cruz. I mean, he really brought Latin influence into the house, as well as Frank Sinatra. Like, he loved crooners and singers. So you had that musical landscape. Plus, growing up in Detroit, good Lord, Motown. I mean, I just, growing up, I was so annoyed. I was like, do we have to hear one more Smokey Robinson in the Miracle song? Do we have to hear Tears of a Clown, like, one more time? You know, but that was really a part of, like, the musical landscape that I grew up in, and that all this music that, like, everybody knew, and people were like, oh yeah, I remember when, you know, Diana Ross and the Supremes were just, you know, over in the Brewster Projects, or we would go see them wherever. So there were all these stories about that. Plus, I don't think I gave you a song, but another big influence for me, of course, is Detroit techno, because that was all that music that was created using the infrastructure of Motown, so that you could be a high school kid, and if you were connected enough, you could actually have a record pressed, because there were record pressing places that were just operational there in the city. So you could just take your track and they'd press it for you, and you could have your own party and then, like, play your own song that you'd produced. I mean, so that felt really specific to Detroit in that moment as well.
I didn't know that about Detroit techno.
I knew it was a big thing, kind of, but I never got. Are there particular artists?
Oh my God, the big three. So you have, like, Derek May, Kevin Saunderson, and Juan Atkins, and then
Juan Atkins. I've heard of
Juan Atkins is amazing. And then there's also, I mean, that's a whole beautiful world. I mean, there's still the movement, the Detroit Electronic Music Festival, which I just went to again a couple of years ago, and it was really fun. It's right on the Detroit River.
I have friends that go every year, and
it's great.
It sounds great. Yeah,
I mean, it's hard because now it's more privatized. It used to be I mean, they the artists had worked it out with the city for it to be basically be free, and it's not free now, so that there's a class maybe shift that's different. But it's the when I was there, it was super well organized. It was clean. Mm. It was fun. It was safe. And there were still a lot of different kinds of people who were there. Although, you know, not as many different kinds of people yeah. as there used to be. But right. I still saw a few of us, I guess I want to say.
I mean, it's interesting to think about, though, if growing up, I mean, you talk about Experiments Joy as a mixtape feel. Mm-hmm. And if you just grown up only listening, maybe your parents weren't that into music. Mm-hmm. Maybe you weren't that into music. You only listened to Smokey Robinson or only listened to one thing, or maybe didn't get into music at all. Maybe this book would be a more straightforward memoir.
That's possible. I mean, I really think that's possible. I mean, I'm a bicultural person, or I'm a hybrid person anyway. I have these two parents who were born in different countries. They're both black, but they have really different cultural experiences, and they were also born on the exact same day, month, and year. So there was
So
there's always this funny thing, like just this lore in my family, like about sameness and difference. That's just been a big dynamic in like growing up. And I do think that there are writers, like I would love for you all to bring someone like Tayari Jones on the show and hear what she listened to. There are certain writers that do feel to me like they've been steeped in a certain kind of music. Or there are certain hip-hop writers like Nate Marshall or mm-hmm. where you can, when you read the work, you can say like, oh, this is a person who I'm sure is a very multifaceted person and has different tastes. But you can tell that there's a certain kind of steeping in an aesthetics that's also related to music. And
that maybe us in this room don't have.
Super eclectic. I mean, yeah. I don't know, but you do.
I think focus can manifest itself in different ways. And sometimes you can be very focused on that diversity without really knowing it. You know? Mm. I mean, you can also get focused on a thing and only, if that focus is your only goal, that can be a defeat in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it can be false, or it can feel contrived, or it can feel as if you're not listening to what's actually happening and just trying to project out what you think is happening for yourself.
I mean, yeah, I just think there's a difference between determination and openness. And sometimes if you're determined to achieve one thing, you're not open to other possibilities because you're only focused on that one thing. And sometimes determination can get you that thing, but you lose other opportunities while you go for it. And then sometimes you end up getting the thing and you're like, I don't even know if I really wanted this now, but I've spent so much time trying to achieve it.
It's sort of like that question about vision, and if you have a strict and controlling vision about what it is you're trying to get, it's hard, because I also think about in collaboration, especially. So collaboration is a little different too, because at some point you have to make a thing, and you're with a bunch of people, and sometimes people are polite, and it's sort of like, okay, but what is the thing that we're going to make? And then you have to start making choices, and so there has to be some clarity there. How you get to that clarity, how you get to those choices, that's where it becomes really interesting. Is it determination? Is it openness? Is it control? Like, what are the mechanisms, and what are the dynamics of trust and communication and nonverbal communication and action and movement, gesture that have to come into it, especially the kind of stuff that I'm interested in doing. And also the tarot and bibliomancy, divination, like how can you actually harness chance? Those are some other things I'm
collaboration?
Interested in. Yeah, you know, I just did this amazing collaboration in Seattle at the Velocity Dance Center. The collaboration was called Wild Beauty, and it was with three really beautiful black dancers, Fox Whitney, Neve Mazik Bianco and Randy Ford. And you know, as we were working, we would pull tarot cards or do bibliomancy or just to shake up or bring in some other element where it wasn't just about like wills or clash of wills or control. Like, see, like, okay, well, what happens if we ask that and then play with what that tells us to do,
right? Where it's not
where we'll go. Yeah,
it's not anybody's specific idea, so it doesn't feel controlled by one person or
it's just play
outside forces.
But you have to have a certain mastery of skill to reach that point, because if you start at the beginning and are like, let's do whatever, it can turn into shambles. I mean, you've been doing what you've been doing for what, 20 plus years? I mean, how long have you been a quote-unquote performance artist? Yeah. I mean, I don't like.
I've been a quote unquote performance artist probably since. Well, I definitely started to try to get inside of those quotes. Like in, I think in 1997, I think that was the first and Swell the Fish when
so
I talk about.
23 years.
Yeah, it's pretty significant. Mean, although, I mean, did I know what I was doing in 1997? That's
well,
questionable.
Right.
Yeah.
But I mean, so then if you had said, let's do whatever with your collaborators, it might not have turned out that well. But the balance of experience 23 years later allows you that latitude. I think sometimes the challenge when working with people who haven't been working in a field for that long is it seems to outside eyes, oh, they're just doing whatever. And you, if you're not steeped in kind of both the actual work that you've done and kind of the experiential work that you've, other things that you've done, I mean, I just think that there's a lot behind the scenes that sometimes doesn't come out to, you know, new eyes, I guess.
You know what's interesting about what you're saying, Jeff? It's like, yes, and also one thing that I mean, because I just taught an excellent class at CalArts last semester, Writing and Performing the Self, and it was integrating in that class actors, we had a dancer, some musicians, writers, and one of the things I think is the hardest for people, especially when they're not in a play, when it's not acting, but you're trying to do live art action, is figure out even how do you work to develop this thing?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so maybe you have some notion that you, we had visual artists, because they actually were kind of good at this. You have a notion that you want to make a thing about something, but how do you materialize that?
Mm-hmm.
And so that sense.
Which is a huge obstacle, too.
It's huge.
I mean, people have ideas all the time. I mean, and sometimes those ideas are great. It's hard to sometimes get them out in the world.
And that's true in every single artistic form. I think, like in poetry, to get that language to work the way that you want it to work, or even understand what the structure or scaffolding of the language should be to try to reach the thing you're trying to reach is hard. And it's that's actually a really delicious stage, though. It's horrible and hard, but where you can kind of imagine this place where you want to get to, but you don't quite have the skills to get there, or you don't know how to get there yet.
Mm-hmm.
And in the MFA program at CalArts where I teach, I remember having an interesting conversation with a student where she just like really wanted somebody to tell her how to do it. She was like, mm-hmm. I know the novel I want to write. I know the characters, but I just need for you all to just give me the craft tips to tell me how to do it. And I said, you know, craft is really important, but I'm not sure that that craft is going to get you there. I think that maybe what you have to do is write your book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the only way you're going to get there is to write. I mean, I could be wrong. And I think the student's super talented and, she'll make it. But I just felt like, so I'm saying all this to say that maybe actually a tarot card, even when you're just beginning, because if you're starting to think, how am I going to learn how to work? Maybe even at the very beginning, pulling from someone else is teaching you that sometimes your own ideas aren't the best way, or sometimes your own ideas aren't going to get you where you want to go. You have to be receptive, or you look at it and you're like, this is stupid. We shouldn't do that, you know. But just starting to learn this kind of expansiveness and how to even work, or even be thinking about that instead of it just being a transparent line from, I think that I'm against the current political system, so I'm going to take a flag and then write I down with the system and then walk outside and that's going to be my artwork. I mean, I feel like there needs to be something to twist that and actually make that more original, more interesting, more impactful. For there to be more risk, for there to be more stakes. But how do you do that? Oh, get assistance from something or someone. I don't know. So,
well, get assistance, but also hone your own receptivity, you know? And that's the hardest thing sometimes
to do. Yes.
Because I think when you are starting out as a younger artist, no matter the medium, you do want guidance. And sometimes it's hard. I mean, I mostly teach poetry, or I teach composition, but when I teach poetry, sometimes people just want, like, yeah, this poem's great, but it's not going to be the end product. I mean, it's going to be kind of a perpetual work in progress,
right?
You know? And yeah, I think sometimes feedback and that type of stuff, and the other thing is everyone deals with feedback differently.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Some people really need positive feedback. Other people, I think, need more critical feedback. And it just kind of depends on what you want to end up. I mean, did you get a lot of feedback when you were young? from teachers, from peers, from, was it negative? Was it positive? Did it kind of run the gamut?
I mean, it ran the gamut in the sense that I remember I identified, I mean, I definitely wanted to be a writer. That was very early. But I also identified as an artist. And it was confusing because I believed that I was an artist or I wanted to be an artist, but I couldn't paint or draw.
But your parents aren't artists.
No.
What did your parents do?
So both of them are in education. My mom started as an elementary science teacher and then ended up becoming an assistant principal and then a principal of an elementary school, a public school in Detroit, Michigan. And she was a principal of one particular school for 20 years before she retired.
Okay.
And then my father was a, and still is, because he said, my parents, they don't know when to quit. So they're both like still partially working just because they love what they do. But a Catholic school, French and Spanish high school teacher.
Okay. Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So lots of language in my house as
but
well.
But not necessarily a lot of art or performance art specifically. Was there books?
Certainly not performance art. The house is full of books and the house is full of art and so much Haitian art because my father would go to Haiti every summer and then bring back these canvases. And some of them were just kind of like really recognizable Haitian tourist art images. And then other things maybe came from galleries. And I don't know how or like what his choices were or how he was picking. But so the house was like full of paintings and sculptures and art. Yeah.
So you had that stuff. But I mean, he wasn't painting in his Saturdays.
No.
Okay.
No. But I loved what you said about needing guidance, because I do think that the reason why music and movies and things can be so important is that when you don't have individual people giving you the guidance, it's like there's this work that's doing something that you're responding to, and it's actually trying. It's like when you listen to your favorite songs over and over again, they're teaching you something about some aesthetic thing that maybe you're trying to get to as well. There can be some things that you just love because they please you, but there are other things, especially the more challenging things, that you're like, I don't know why I like this, but I do. Or I hate this, except now I love this. You know what I mean? So how is it achieving that effect? I think about Bjork's album, Medulla. That's a difficult album. And, you know, I love her so much, but that was a record that, initially, I was like, what is she doing here?
There's no instruments. It's all vocal.
Vocal.
Yeah, right.
Although that's even, so I mean, that's even more accessible than something like Biophilia.
Yeah.
Or even that last thing, I'm still not there with her necessarily. Is that Utopia?
Oh, yeah.
Do you all like that?
I think I just heard the, if there was a single, that I think I heard that, but I didn't listen to the album. I listened to Biophilia, though.
Let's listen to Where is the Line really
quick. Oh, yes! Because that's got that dude, Mike.
Well, we're not going to get there, but we'll listen to
I know, because that's like in minute 8 or something. But anyway.
Where is the line with you? Where is the line with you?
For playing that, it's
well,
so good.
You put her on your list. I mean, she's definitely kind of, because from post to debut to homogenic. How do you say it?
Homogenic.
Yeah, but I mean, I thought about her because I used to really like Bjork and kind of like you and maybe you too, Joshua. I mean, I haven't liked her latest albums as much, but at the same time, I guess I respect her maybe all the more because of that.
Yeah,
she definitely has her own lane and it's not for everyone, and I think she's developed as an artist in ways that are particular to her own individuality and maybe not a broader, you know, like Debut was a very kind of catchy pop album, as was Post. So I mean, I don't know, I guess
Yeah, the leap for her was really homogenic. Something happened in that third record where she, and both, I love those first two records, but you all of a sudden she really was in her own lane in Homogenic, and like Hunter is an incredible, mm-hmm. incredible song. But the whole thing, or even that's a great record. Although the of the recent Björk albums, Vulnikura, yeah. that's a wonderful Stone Milker. That's an amazing song. I saw her, my dear friend Madhu Kaza, who's mentioned in both of these books, we saw her, could it even have been at Carnegie Hall or something, on the Vulnikura tour. And that was amazing because there was no opening act. And then she was there with Arca, the Hacks and Cloak. So they were, those two were in the back. And then she had this ring of string musicians who were all dressed in white. And they had a name that was something called, like, the Army of Beauty, or I'm sure that's not what it was, but like they had a name, and it was just her, those two kind of electronic musicians, and then strings, and that was who was on stage. And then she just came out there with this jeweled thing over her head and just started to sing her songs. And then she took that jeweled thing off, and then she just started to rock out. And I feel like Björk, for me, she represents that individuality that you mentioned, Jeff, and also just this woman artist who is on her path, mm-hmm. and is constantly seeking and isn't afraid to be weird, isn't afraid to be unlikable. Although, I mean, people ride for her so hard, but, you know, especially in Iceland.
Some people don't like her, too.
Oh, right. Some people really don't like her. They don't like her voice. They think it's precious. They think it's twee. They think it's pretentious. But I feel like, for me, especially coming from a Black urban environment, I was inspired by this idea, like, oh, you can be that. And that's where some of the people like Twigs or mm-hmm. Sudan Archives or just bringing in different kinds of sounds. That was exciting to me because I felt growing up, especially in this sort of post-Black arts movement moment, I felt a lot of pressure to express my own identity and creativity a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And there was tension there because I felt very proud to be Black, and I never wanted to come off as if I didn't want to be associated with Blackness. But then I also felt like there was all of this space, all of these images and approaches that were exciting to me. And I felt that there was pressure not to go in that direction. And so but I was attracted to, like, Kate Bush, The Hounds of Love, or I was attracted to these things because of the world building in part. Like, Björk, all these people I just mentioned, I think even Sudan Archives, Twigs, definitely, if you listen to Magdalene, these people are building world, or even Solange. That second album is more divisive for me, or I find, like, half of it I really love and the other half.
Seated at the Table, or
When I Come Home, or okay. When I Get Home, mm-hmm. I think.
Which is her latest one.
That's okay. The latest one.
Yeah.
But like a song like Bends or Stay Flow, or those records are amazing. And then Mad, I love off of the first. But see, Mad.
Let's listen to a quick second of it. Is that your favorite song on that album?
That is a fantastic song.
It sounds so good
that
on headphones.
Is, yes.
I've never had on headphones
before.
You can hear
the layer.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
All right, you all are convincing me with headphones. I need to go and listen. It is my favorite song on the album. I love the combination of kind of what I think of as hard and soft. I love what Lil Wayne is doing on mm-hmm. that record. I love how the harmonies sort of harken back to early girl groups. So mm-hmm. that's like my little Detroit self in it. I love the way that song is also speaking back to stereotypes about the angry black woman, mm-hmm. and how it's speaking truth in a way that is soft but is also hard or honest or candid, you know. And it makes me think a little bit even of like Minnie Riperton or somebody. I mean, people who have that whisper, but they're really strong and clear and amazing. And so the idea that you need to pay attention and that the actual quality of sound, something can sound soft and be penetrating, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or be about hard things. So you have to really pay attention to what's happening.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I don't listen to Solange a lot, and I've only listened to that album a couple of times. I mean, I think it's interesting, too, how I'm sure it's a conscious effort, how different while simultaneously kind of in the same... She's different than her sister.
Very.
But they're sisters. And yeah. I mean, when one will come under fire, will one, like, they support one another, I'm sure, unconditionally. Mm-hmm. But... she was definitely before that album, too. I think she was really in Beyonce's kind of shadow, right?
For sure. Mm-hmm.
But now she's, you know, and you know her career more than me, but now she's her own thing. And I mean, this was a huge.
Did she just have the EP before this? Because I listened to that a lot.
Is that the EP that Blood Orange produced? There was that thing. Mm-hmm. And then she had maybe a couple of albums. Soul Angel and the Hadley, whatever. Okay. I mean, she's definitely still in Beyonce's shadow to bow down, but she, and you know, because I'm a little sister, I'm always for the little sister.
Yeah.
Although
I was gonna say, you mentioned your older sister, is she in the arts?
My sister is a physician, and right now she's on a Fulbright
to
Ghana. I think of us as the Williams sisters. I was just thinking about that because I was listening to a podcast, Ashley Graham's Pretty Big Deal, the episode with Serena Williams. And I was thinking like, yeah, my sister and I, we've done pretty well, which is wild. And I feel it's a little Venus and Serena energy. Like we love each other a lot. I don't think we don't compete so much, but my sister is a quieter person. But she was the original Prince fan. She definitely loves music. But she loves like 70s music, funk, but also she loves America. Like I went to the desert on a horse with no name. Like stuff that Elton John. I mean, things that I don't have great interest in.
Interesting.
ABBA. Yeah. She can roll with. I don't roll with ABBA.
I don't roll with any of that.
I don't roll with ABBA.
No one rolls with ABBA here.
But so many people love ABBA, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
people really do. Yeah,
they really do. It's shocking to me.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
I mean, different demographics.
No judgment.
ABBA back
no judgment
in the day sold millions and millions of records.
Exactly.
Do you mean now in 2020, or do you mean
there's
just
like a nostalgic thing that people will still rep for them, you know, in a way that I'm maybe not. I was like, someone was like, "Do you want to go see Mamma Mia?" And I was like, "Please no."
Right, and I feel a vast freedom when I don't like things like that because there are a lot of other people who like them.
Yeah, that's right. So no shade on you, Swedish friends.
Yeah, there's
do your thing.
Yeah, there's plenty of room.
All right, I want to listen to this song, and then it kind of goes to where we can end on success, kind of what you were talking about. So this has a long title, but it's called "Come with Success."
Whoa, that slap, they say they want that slap. It's not so separately, they know I come with that. Hey, what you got? Honey's overlapping, that's a fact. I'm on my level, nigga, you better come correct. Kill they ass with success, they won't like that. Kill they ass with success, they won't like that. Kill they ass with success, they won't like that. Kill they ass with success, ordinary, I am not that. Tattoos on arm and neck. Grew like a crash dummy, head first for a jack. Gung ho for a fist full of blue bread. Girl, that ass swole, let me grab a hold and suplex. Go for broke in that pussy, cause I remember when niggas flipped.
I love that song.
Yeah, so Schoolboy Q, 2 Chainz, Michael Made It, Ears, Kill 'Em with Success. How'd you discover that?
I think the first time I heard it was probably at the end of Creed 2.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So but as soon as I heard it, I was like, wait a minute. That's a Gabrielle song. I mean, some of the language is not necessarily like super in my black feminist mode. However,
the message.
And also the beats and the sample and the ingenuity and the brio, the verve. But also there is swag. I mean, I think that there's something. There is a part of me that is definitely ambitious, and it's sort of like I came to win. And that's what I like about hip hop. I like about even sort of trap music that can be tricky. There is an unabashed confidence or an unabashed swagger, and an unabashed, like, you know what, let's go get it. Let's go do it. We don't have time for all this. Let's take it. Let's make it. Let's make it happen. And a song like that can inspire me or remind me, like, yeah, you know what, go get it.
Yeah. But when you were younger, were you ashamed of that kind of ambition, or were you more kind of coy? Or
I think that even now, I feel like there's a part of me that wants sort of collective and community success, for example, or development or growth. I feel, especially politically, that I've often been in environments where it was people had ambivalence about ambition. Desire for success, whether that was this idea. So it was really interesting because on the one hand you had like in rap songs, so like hip hop is a big word and so I have to be careful, but like in certain rap songs there would be unabashed desire for wealth or, you know, prosperity or excess. But then if you were positive or you were progressive, then you weren't supposed to be about that, and you were supposed to be about I don't know, everyone being together. Or this idea, too, that if you're a feminist, which I am a very strong one.
But wait, are you talking like native tongues, like De La, Common, Tribe? Or are you just talking like generally? Like,
sure. Like, I think definitely those were. But I mean.
Versus.
Or maybe I'm talking about being a serious feminism. It's almost like rap music versus black feminism or something, mm-hmm. which I think today that beef is, or that binary. There are a lot of black feminists, including like the Crunk Feminist Collective, like the, you know, Brittany Cooper, Robin Morgan. There are different people who have talked about a more complex relationship to sort of like male rappers and what's happening and aggression. And I mean, there's a lot of different things, a different kind of cultural values that have been projected or ascribed onto music, like onto music that's like a song like this, which is not even just about content, but the drive of the beat. Mm-hmm. The masculine voices and how they claim, and just this like kill, you know, just this, these verbs, kill their ass with success. They won't mm-hmm. like that. Like, who, so that there's something aggressive there. It has to do with my own relationship to aggression. So I think growing up, what does it mean to claim your own power? What does it mean not to question yourself? What does it mean to believe that you can go get what you want? Who was modeling that? Although my parents were modeling it.
Mm-hmm. But they weren't as in your face modeling it, right? They were doing it by example, not like.
And I was trained to be a good girl. See, that's the whole thing. I feel like that's really the story of Swallow the Fish, how somebody who was trained to be like a good girl and be respectful and get good grades and go to college and whatever. I mean, I couldn't believe Jeff Alessandrelli on an earlier episode of The Steer, which you should look up. You know, there was this whole thing that I heard you talk about, like, oh, you know, high school, you know, do I seem like a guy who really, you know, liked high school, and then this idea that you were kind of a derelict. And then you said, because I just listened to this to prepare for today. But then when you were just like, well, I was only arrested one time. That's not much. And I just thought, like, oh, my goodness.
I was arrested three times, but.
So you lied on an earlier episode?
Well, we're all different people in different circumstances, course, in different lives. Yeah. I mean, what? Why are you bringing that up?
Well, I'm just bringing it up because I thought, like, oh, my God, if I had even been, like, talked to by a cop, I just would have been in so much trouble. My parents were strict, and also I went to college when I was 16 years old, so I was like such a little kid, you know. So what it really means for me to like claim power, and how songs like that become models, and you know, to say like, go get it. So it's like a way to borrow swag or something.
Like, that's not a good girl thing to do.
To kill their ass.
Yeah,
success,
right.
They won't that.
Right.
Yeah. Or to floss or to flaunt or to say, like, yeah, you know what? Uh-huh. Well, my book won the prize, or whatever.
Well, yeah, but you're by any metrics. I mean, yeah, Experiments in Joy was just long list nominated for the Believer Book Awards nonfiction. Like, I mean, any metric, you're a successful person, but do you struggle with that success?
Well, I definitely.
I mean, it sounds like on some level you did, or I don't know if you currently do, but.
Well, I also feel like, I mean, I'm ambitious, and so I think, like, I'm like, okay, this is the beginning. Like, I'm starting to get there. I feel blessed. I feel fortunate. I feel lucky. I feel thankful. And I feel successful in the sense that, but that's like, I feel like I feel more, you know, fortunate or lucky, or like, oh my goodness, I'm so thankful to have this job that has benefits. I feel lucky to be able to have a job where I get to do things. But this idea, do I feel like a success?
But you put yourself in a position to get lucky. I mean, lucky sounds like you're walking down the street and you find $20. Oh, that's lucky. But I mean, you also manifested that luck, right?
I worked.
Like, so
hard.
It's not like you just fell into MF or whatever your job is.
Yeah.
Well,
no.
When people say lucky, sometimes it's like, I was lucky to get it, and you were, but also behind that luck is a lot of hard work.
You know what it is too, though. You're helping me figure it out, because also it's also about reckoning with my privilege. It's about reckoning with the fact that, like, I'm a first generation middle class person. My parents were not middle class, either one of them, but they hooked up their lives in such a way for my sister to be that, and then wondering, should I feel guilt for the success that I have,
right.
You know, or how do you negotiate that? And how do you be responsible? But then at the same time, in many of my communities, so many people are lifted up. Like, even if you think about a Beyonce and Jay-Z, they're unabashed about their wealth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then even many progressive people that I know who love them, and there isn't necessarily a lot of critique around. And it's like, oh, look, they gave $1 million to XYZ. Well, how many millions of dollars do they have? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So there's some kind of like double standard that I feel like I'm trying to negotiate within myself. I don't feel low self-esteem per se, but I do, it is true, feel like I'm trying to be thoughtful about where is it? If I say that I'm ambitious, what am I trying to manifest? Where am I trying to go? And that's where I know Janice Lee, who was the guest that you were interviewing on that episode of The Steer, where I've just brought back
your jail-ridden episode.
I know, I'm so sorry that I brought it back, but you were just like, "That's no big deal," and you know,
okay.
It isn't.
No, it's fine.
But
it's
good
years
because
ago.
We have to.
There were no permanent charges.
We take the stigma away from incarcerated people
well,
anyway.
Okay,
but, yeah.
But I'm not. I am not the poster. I mean, yeah.
Yes, I'm. Yes.
I know you're not saying that, but
no, but it's good. But I think she just has a new essay that came out that's really talking about, what are the expectations for, let's say, literary career or artistic career? Where are we trying to get to? So even if I'm like, yeah, I want to kill your ass with success, what is that? What am I trying to do? Am I trying to be like this American Dirt writer and get a 7-figure advance? Like, what am I trying to do?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I want to think about. And at the same time, I get to dream big if I want to. I get to have those dreams and I get to work for them. I just need to be clear for myself, what is it that I'm trying to do? And so I'm in that process.
And
right
success is defined differently by different people, and I mean especially on different stages of your career, too.
Sure.
I mean, anyone's career.
Like, what is success for you?
I think success for me is writing things that I feel proud about and trying to get them in the world in some small or large way. But I also really like doing things like this, and I like I like making things too and working with people and being able to do that. I mean, so even if I also know that I like fairly esoteric texts and I like fairly weird things. So I'm aware that it's not going to, you know, that a lot of the stuff that I write or that I put out isn't going to be huge. So, I mean, I'm not trying to get some huge readership necessarily or huge listenership for the kind of records or stuff that I do. But who knows, too? I don't necessarily put a cap on it. What about you, Joshua?
Yeah, what about you, Joshua?
I think I have a weird idea of success, and I struggle with it all the time. But, I don't know. I think a lot about, connection and relationship, even though I don't do a lot of direct collaboration, I do think of that, you know, that kind of, like building creative community or community in general as a measure of success for myself. I don't know what it means artistically. I just, you know, as long as I keep making things and people keep
experiencing them in some way and responding to them, that feels pretty successful. So I don't really have, I don't, like you said, I don't put a cap on it. I dream big, but I don't get disappointed if those big dreams don't happen. So,
well, yeah, and if success is winning the Nobel Prize in Literature, or like, I mean, people have different sometimes visions. And if you only want to do one thing, and that's to make a number, I mean, I guess I just think that you have to kind of be fluid in terms of how you define that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel pretty lucky in that.
Yeah, exactly.
My family is not very success driven, you know.
Uh-huh.
And like, my mom's a mail carrier. And, you know, my uncle, who was kind of my dad growing up, is a musician, plays piano in hotels and stuff, used to do a solo act and stuff. And, like, you know, for them, that's really,
right.
They feel really successful doing that stuff. And I think they are, you know,
right.
And they're just kind of like, you know, as long as you're, like, supporting yourself, you're successful. And so in that level, the bar was really low in a good way, in a way that I felt really, you know, like, I have a lot of friends whose parents really pushed them into things, and maybe that could have been good for me in some respects, but in a lot of ways that was really nice to not have that pressure. I mean, they're just kind of proud no matter what I do. They're confused by not making very much money and making a lot of things, you know, and like doing jobs that aren't, that don't, you know, add up really well financially. And so they're confused about that stuff, but they're supportive of that too. So I feel really lucky, because I talk to a lot of friends who are just like, oh, so much pressure, and I want to be an artist, but they want me to, and I'm like, oh yeah, I've never felt that before, you know.
Wait, you know, the last thing I want to say about success, and listening to the two of you really reinforces it. I think for me, a deep marker of success is liking your life.
That's true.
Yeah.
And people sometimes, that's probably the most important one, right?
Yeah, you can make a lot of money, but if you don't like your life, then
and a lot of people who make a lot of money don't really like their lives.
Right.
And I feel like that's maybe the essence of what we all said, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the line that just sums it all up. I have one last question. I know we wrap up, but I was really intrigued by so many of the artists you brought up being these, not that they didn't collaborate, but people like Prince, like Joni, who else did you bring? Kate Bush,
mm-hmm.
Bjork, you know, all of these have, you know, collaborated in their work in really wonderful ways and really kind of notable ways that we still talk about today, or, you know, but so many, all of them are just so, have such a vision,
mm-hmm.
and are so driven, and sometimes get this control freak label put on them, and how inspiring they were to you, and just kind of the way they hone their power or something, you know. But but so much of your work is about collaboration, about not being a control freak, about, you know, like, kind of letting go.
Well, I said,
you know,
that term. It's the wrong term.
No, but I mean people do use it, so I don't think it's the wrong term, because, you know, it's all those artists have had that label put on them at some time, you know. And so I guess that might just be one of those, you know, like, small contradictions that you've been talking about, that you just kind of have to hold and be with in life, you know, because life is full of so many contradictions. But how do you think about that, you know, that them inspiring you as figures, but your work being so collaborative and so in many ways open?
I've never thought of it that way, and I want to think about it more, because I do think I'm so drawn to the auteur. I'm so drawn to the person who can come out and, like, do their thing.
Yeah.
And then when I move out, it ends up not necessarily being the way that I work. Although some of the work that I do is like that, but there is a desire for multiplicity, or for contributions from other people or sources, or even all the epigraphs or in Swallow the Fish, you know, I include in both books, actually, there's text by other people, whether
it's a decent amount of text.
By other people. And so I guess I'm social.
Yeah.
I don't want to be lonely. I want all these other things in with me. I wish you could have seen Jeff sort of roll his eyes.
I didn't roll my eyes. We're all social. Of course we're social.
I thought that was a great answer, social. Jeff.
These are social books.
Jeff is like my brother. I feel like I like to Josh Jeff.
All right. All right. Last thing. What's your favorite color?
Orange.
All right. Doesn't rhyme. Okay. Thank you, Gabrielle.
Bye. The Steer is recorded at KBOO Studios in Portland, Oregon. It's broadcast through Dublab Radio, KZUT in Los Angeles, and can be found anywhere you listen to podcasts. Thanks for joining us.